You can argue that Kubernetes has accelerated productivity in some dimensions, right? Like the last mile software delivery. Clearly, cloud beats CD-ROMs any day of the week. The flip side is developing for the cloud is way more complicated and way more responsibility and way more to understand than just building a GUI Windows app using Microsoft Foundation classes.
Hello and welcome to Committing to Cloud Native, the podcast where we talk about the confluence of open source and the cloud, what it means to do open source at cloud native scale. Today, we have two panelists on. We have Justin Dorfman, and we're joined by Suri Bar Yohe, who is the CTO and co-founder of Reblaze. Our guest today is Richard Lee. Richard is calling in from Boston, where he is the co-founder and CEO of Ambassador Labs, which works on open source tools for Kubernetes. Super excited about this conversation. Take it away, Justin.
Hey, Richard. How are you?
Great to be here, Justin.
Awesome. Suri is joining us. How are you doing?
I'm great. Very happy to have Richard on our podcast.
I agree. You got him here, so I really appreciate that. So for those who don't know, Richard is the co-founder and CEO of Ambassador Labs, which builds popular open source tools for Kubernetes. You know, there's one thing that is driving me crazy. We got DataWire, we got Ambassador API Gateway, we have a missionary ingress. Can you explain all these brand changes and everything to me so I am up to date?
Sure. Yeah, it's confusing. It's life as a startup, right? So we started, and funny story I'll tell you, is we started our company as DataWire. And the only reason it was called DataWire was because my co-founder and I, we were sitting around and we said, well, we're starting a company. The company needs a name and the name needs, we need a website. So we ended up basically just using instant domain search and just typing in random things. And we ended up with DataWire. And it was a Black Friday sale. It was $5. So that was the name of the company. And then we built these different projects. One was Telepresence. And then we built this thing called Ambassador API Gateway. The reason we called it Ambassador API Gateway was because it was built on Envoy, and an Envoy proxy, an Envoy in sort of US Department of State hierarchy actually reports to an ambassador. So ambassador is sort of a higher level Envoy. And so that's what we created. Most people started to associate us really with the Ambassador API Gateway. So we rebranded the company to Ambassador Labs. So today we're officially Ambassador Labs. Our products are Ambassador API Gateway and Telepresence, but it gets more complicated because we wanted to donate Ambassador API Gateway to the CNCF. And the CNCF says, well, in order to donate the technology, we need to take your trademark, which is Ambassador. And we said, well, but that's the name of our company. And they said, well, the only thing you can do is to rename it. And so we said, okay. So we picked a different type of ambassador called an emissary. So there's Envoy, there's emissary, there's ambassador, all part of this theme. And so now today, we're Ambassador Labs. We make the emissary ingress. We make telepresence. And that's what it is. So that's where we're consolidating. We don't really use the word data wire anymore. And it's really emissary, telepresence, and Ambassador Labs.
I can totally relate to you on that because when I was at a company called MaxCDN, our parent company was NetDNA. So everyone was just like, well, is MaxCDN part of NetDNA or is NetDNA independent? It was such a hassle. But over time, they'll eventually get that differentiation. Now, Suri, you know all about CNCF licensing and all that. Maybe you want to give a little insight to your experience.
Well, just like, you know, luckily with CureFence, we did something different. So we have Reblaze, the company, and the project named CureFence. So we didn't have to run to this challenge. But indeed, most of the people coming to open source with naive approach, and we just wanted to donate something. And all of a sudden, it became legal and paperwork and trademark transformations and so on. And yeah, you need to take care of it beforehand. And think well with naming, I would say.
Yeah, that was the first time where Suri actually sent me a dude email, or I think it was a Slack message, because like I signed the papers for the trademark stuff without clearing it with him. So it was funny because I was just trying to get this thing through the door because, you know, time was the essence. But what I like about working at Reba is that you can ask for forgiveness rather than permission. So Anyway, so getting back to the new project that you donated, I read down the new stack like a couple days ago that you did the donation. Now, what are your expectations to getting to graduation? Like, do you see this as a long-term thing, or are you looking to accelerate getting it to the next level? Because right now it's a sandbox, right?
It's an incubation project.
Oh, it's incubated.
It's incubation.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, Ambassador API Gateway or Emissary Ingress, it's been around for 3 or 4 years, and there's an amazing roster of companies that use it and in production. So we were just talking with the largest video streaming company in India, and they live stream cricket matches, and all their traffic goes through our API Gateway and Envoy proxy. And they were telling us how in 5 minutes, when the cricket match starts, they go from 1 million requests per minute to 6 million requests per minute. And it's just a horizontal pod autoscaler in Kubernetes, and it just works. So we have a lot of real world heavy deployments running at scale. And really for us, the biggest thing we're trying to do is really grow that community of contributors. We have about 150 part-time contributors to the project, and we're really looking to create and encourage other people to step up to be maintainers of the project as well, in addition to just contributing on a feature basis. So like Puppet Labs, there's a great team of engineers there. They contributed all this stuff around Knative scaling. We'd love for other people, not just to contribute features, but really help us maintain, grow, evolve that project.
Wow, 150 contributors is pretty impressive. How long did it take you to get to 150?
So we started the project in 2017. We released the first version in June of 2017, and it started taking off pretty quickly just because people were starting to recognize the power of Envoy proxy, and people also were starting to try to deploy in Kubernetes. And if you've ever tried to use Envoy proxy on its own and then try to use deploy it on, much less deploy it on Kubernetes, you would realize, oh, this is actually quite complicated. And so we built the software to make it easy to run Envoy on Kubernetes. So I would say probably 2 or 3 years for us to get to the 150, but we started having contributors probably within 6 months of our initial release, contributing significant functionality.
Got it. Now, do you work closely with the Envoy team? How does that work?
We have one of our engineers actually maintains parts of Envoy, specifically the external authorization filter, which we depend pretty heavily on. I think he also does a few other components. So he's sort of our lead person in working with Envoy. And then we also are part of the Envoy distributors group because we repackage Envoy. So when there's security errata, we get notified about it. And so last night, it was a little bit of a late night because it was a kind of an exciting process to get the security patches in Envoy out. And then once Envoy gets the security patches out, we then have to do all these builds to get a new release of the API gateway out. So we talk to the Envoy community quite a bit. And I would say we're really just part of the Envoy community.
Richard, you wrote this product, the API Gateway, that now goes by the name Emissary Ingress, right? I believe it's, 400, 500 organizations are using it right now.
It's a little hard to tell, right? But we have 5,000 people in our Slack. So, and they're generally from different organizations. So we think, you know, our best guess, we're probably in the tens of thousands because, you know, not everyone who installs us creates a Slack account. Is it 10,000? Is it 20,000? 50,000? Hard to say.
So this is a success story by all measures, I would say. And given the open source aspect to the story, I would love if you could elaborate a little bit about, you know, to our listeners, to us, Curie fans as well, what are the rules, the ground rules, the golden rules that you would say to build a successful open source project? What are the one or two things we must do from the very beginning to keep the project interesting to the community and to get it out and simply reach out to those achievements, I would say.
Especially if you're a startup, I think the two areas I would focus on is make it easy to install and use. And then two, sort of correlated to that, is have good documentation. And the reason why I say if you're a startup is because if you're a startup, you don't have a lot of marketing brand and those kinds of things. And so developers just want to see that there's good documentation and they are able to try it and use it quickly. And that was a big thing. I actually wrote a lot of the original documentation for Ambassador. And I put a lot of effort into it. That was a big part of my job in the early days. And the exception is if you're a really big company like Google, you could ship something like Istio, which is actually quite impossible to use, but you could still get a lot of people to use it. So I would say if you're a big company, you can get away with shipping very complex software.
That was great.
Sorry, we're kind of going to through
it. No, we're going through an Istio thing right now. So it was just kind of like perfect timing.
Whenever someone says, I love Istio, the first question I ask them is, have you ever tried to upgrade Istio in production?
That's exactly what's happening.
So
we just had a call with a customer who's using CuriFence, and this is the exact same thing. It's kind of crazy.
Everyone loves Istio until they try to upgrade it in production, at which point they realize it's actually terrifying.
Yep. It's definitely not a simple platform. So Richard, may you elaborate a little bit about having a business on top of an open source and such success open source? Where do you draw the line between the paid and the free and all those, you know, the ecosystem around it and all sort of?
My opinion is my next company is I'm not going to do an open source company because you really have to figure out two different kinds of products. And that's twice as much work as a regular kind of company. That's my opinion.
That sounds like Adam from Chef, I believe. He said the same thing. He's like, I'm never doing an open source company again.
It's just like, yeah, exactly, right? Because you've got to figure out this open source product that has lots of value that people love. And then you have to figure out another product that people will love even more and are willing to pay money for. So you really have to figure out this thing twice. And then you have all these constraints on that commercial thing, because if you try to take away too many features from the open source thing to get upset, et cetera, right? So the approach that we've taken that has been recently successful for us has been, we have a bunch of high-end enterprise features like single sign-on and rate limiting and things like that. But what we do is we wanted to avoid forking. And so what we did was we actually exposed all these APIs in the open source. And we basically say, if you want to build your own authentication, rate limiting, et cetera, these are a set of documented APIs that you can use. And we use the exact same APIs. And so if you choose not to actually put that energy into building your own implementation, you can use our implementation, which just is packaged as a proprietary sidecar onto the open source. So there's no forking. And every time we need more capability in the proprietary, we will evolve these open source APIs, but you can always use these APIs yourself. And so that has seemed to have worked reasonably well. But I would say, you know, Zuri, there's just no easy answer. It's just complicated. Quite frankly, you know, sometimes I go, oh my goodness, it's such a pain in the neck. We are where we are.
We are already in it, Richard.
Yes.
We are. I think that's actually pretty cool that you have those APIs that are just not private. I've heard gripes from developers who write on top of the, you know, for like iOS developers that are just so frustrated with Apple that they get access to some APIs and then they don't get them. So I think that's a good way of going about it. But at the same time, turning that into a profitable business, I don't know. I mean, you know better than I, and you seem pretty frustrated. But I think overall, I mean, what you're doing for the cloud native ecosystem seems to be helping a lot of companies that could turn into monthly recurring revenue or whatever packages you sell? Or is that just not the case yet?
I would say it's a lot of work, and I'm being a little facetious because we actually have a huge roster of paying customers who are paying us annual subscriptions and giving us really great feedback around our products and using more and more of our products. So we have a lot of API gateway customers who then start using telepresence for development. We just launched a cloud product. So there's a lot of things that we figured out with our customers' help that around what are ways we can provide additional value beyond the open source. So I think in the end, it's actually worth it because from a distribution perspective, we don't have an army of salespeople who are cold calling customers and saying, hey, I've got an API gateway for Kubernetes. Do you want it? Right? Which as a developer, I actually appreciate because I don't like getting emails and cold calls from people who have no idea what I'm doing, trying to sell me something that I don't need.
Well, especially with, you know, how things are changing where the developers are actually like the purchasing power. That's just what I read. I don't know if that's true or not, but, you know, developers are never going to answer a call from someone they don't know. So I think the way that channel, you know, being in the landscape seems to be working, as you say. So it's good to know that the CNCF has that type of power to build an actual ecosystem that can sustain companies and give good jobs to developers. And it's exciting to work in open source. It's just not, as you said, it's not easy.
Yeah.
I want to go over your resume a little bit. It's pretty impressive. You have Red Hat, Rapid7, you've done product management and product marketing. Tell me a little bit about your experience at Red Hat. Why did you move on to becoming an entrepreneur and so on?
Yeah, I think I've always been an entrepreneur at heart. At Red Hat was a super entrepreneurial company when I got there. So I was in engineering, and then I was able to move into sales, and then I was able to move from sales into marketing. So I got exposure to lots of parts of an open source business that was really growing. And so it was a really exciting time. Met a lot of really great people. And then Rapid7 came calling and they said, well, Richard, you've done some engineering, you've done some marketing, some sales. So seems like you could probably do product, which is requires a little bit of understanding of all of these things. So joined Rapid7, was fortunate enough to be part of this huge ride. And then, you know, we started getting bigger and I thought, well, do I really want to run this sort of big sort of product organization? And long story short, I said, you know, I want to do an even earlier stage startup. I was employee number 600 something at Red Hat. Then I was employee 60 something at Rapid7. And then I think I was employee 30, 25, somewhere around there at Duo. And I just wanted to go earlier. And so I joined Duo, learned a bunch of stuff there. And then I said, okay, if I want to do something even earlier than Duo, it really just means starting my own company. And so that's what I ended up doing. So wasn't as conscious as I've sort of made it out, but that's sort of how things have happened. And, you know, there's different things you learn at every single stage. If you're a 600 person company, you just run differently from 60 people, which is how you run differently from 20. So
are you at 60 right now?
We are about 50 people right now. So we're closing in on 60, but not quite. So, but if anyone wants to apply for a job, we'll get to 60. So,
okay. Are you the type of CEO where they could just email you directly?
Sure. I mean, we're hiring engineers, marketers, dev rel, so product growth. So yeah, so you could email me, richard@datawire.io. We haven't changed your domain yet because it's actually a lot of work. Or you could check out our job listings on the ambassador website.
Great. Now, I saw another thing that caught my eye, O'Reilly Velocity Conference. That was one of my favorite conferences in the world when I was in the CDN space. Steve Sodders and Guy Pod are like two guys that I really look up to. What were you doing in the space? Like, I don't think you're working at a CDN, or what part of your career got you into the Velocity conference?
As CEO of Ambassador Labs, we started talking about ingress controllers and networking at Velocity. So I gave a talk.
Okay.
This was in the early days of Kubernetes, but just like sort of some of the nuances of Kubernetes networking and ingress controllers, because even today people get very confused about sort of why you need these things and what they're all about. So I gave a talk at Velocity and I met a bunch of cool people there. So
yeah, rest in peace, Velocity. I think, what are they now? Like, is it the Fluent conference or something?
Yeah, and O'Reilly, didn't they kill sort of their events business for a while? I don't even know if they're bringing it back.
Oh, yeah.
So,
I totally forgot. Yeah.
So all everything. These events are sort of a thing of the past.
Yeah. I mean, O'Reilly, to me, threw the best events. My dream was to do a talk for OzCon, and I got to do it, luckily. But, you know, I am definitely sad that I won't be able to attend future OzCons, because I think OzCon for me was just such a amazing experience because I'm so into open source and that's what everyone's going there to talk open source. But yeah, good times, but you know, everything does go on. Zuri.
So Richard, you mentioned you starting a company. I'd like to, if you can elaborate a little bit about the process of starting a company. Was it a decision to become an entrepreneur and then finding a problem to solve? Or did you have a specific problem such as the API gateway? What was the first product? What was the first thing you worked on? And
so yeah, Zuri, great question. So, you know, I'm an entrepreneur at heart. I think you're either an entrepreneur or you're not. And you know, you can work at a larger company, but you're always sort of thinking about how you create things from scratch. And so I knew after leaving Duo, I wanted to start a company. I didn't know what to do. So I didn't have any ideas. So I just started talking to anyone just to try to figure out what problems they had. And so originally I thought, oh, I think the metrics and monitoring space was ripe for disruption. And so I actually started looking at building a competitor to Datadog, Wavefront, Signal Fuse. So there was just this cohort of next-gen monitoring companies. So looked into that, decided it was very hard to compete. Then I ended up discovering microservices. So started iterating around a service mesh. And that conclusion came to be that market was, it was too early. This was 2014 for us to really get traction on a service mesh. And ultimately, we converged around Kubernetes and seeing that when you start adopting Kubernetes, there's some very essential parts that you need. You need an API gateway because otherwise there's no way to connect your application to the internet. So that's pretty foundational. You need a way to actually develop software. So that's where telepresence came into play. And so it was definitely not an overnight idea. It was definitely an evolution of our thinking over, I'd call it probably 18 to 24 months before we really started to have conviction around what would make sense for us.
And did you go bootstrap? Did you raise money? How did this process went?
I bootstrapped it just myself for the first probably year of the process. And then once I had an idea of where we wanted to go, I raised a little bit of a seed round so that we could build out a team. And then from there, we've been venture funded since then, raising additional rounds as we've expanded and gotten more traction and that sort of thing.
You mentioned telepresence twice already during the conversation. I believe we should hang on this great product for a few minutes. Do you mind elaborating about telepresence, what it does, and how it's actually changed the development lifecycle?
Yeah, I think one of the things is that what developers discover is that when they start developing a microservices-based application on Kubernetes, life gets very complicated. And in particular, when you have an application that is microservices-based, it's really running in the cloud. It's not running locally. And that means you can't use your IDE, your debugger, or any of these other tools that you're used to using. And your development loop of making a code change suddenly becomes make a code change, build a container, push the container to the registry, deploy it on Kubernetes, and then test it. It's very time-consuming, and it kills your productivity. And so what telepresence does is it basically creates a network connection between the remote cluster and your laptop. So your laptop is almost as if it's running in the cluster. And so by doing this, you could actually run one of your services that you're developing, or more of them, locally on your laptop, which means you can use your IDE, your debugger, everything, while that one microservice can still talk to everything else in the cluster. And there's a lot of sort of additional sophistication we've layered in, but fundamentally, it's about bringing the power of local development into your Kubernetes development workflow.
Hybriding.
Yes. We call it hybrid. The story I like to tell is, because some people run Minikube and things like that, and I basically say, have you noticed now that your laptop is really hot on your lap when every time you're doing development, because you're basically burning all your CPU and memory? You can actually cause yourself physical discomfort during development, and we can alleviate that physical discomfort with software. So when your laptop's melting down, you should switch to telepresence.
As I said, we'll change your development lifecycle.
Exactly.
That's what it is, Richard.
I got a question. So in the latest CNCF Cloud Native survey, 26% of respondents say they use managed Kubernetes services. That's up from 23% last year. Does that threaten your business?
Not at all. We are very supportive of the managed Kubernetes providers just because, first of all, most of our customers, or a lot of our customers, are running in one of the managed Kubernetes clouds. And for us, it's really about, by making it easier for other organizations to adopt Kubernetes, it makes it easier for them to actually adopt our software, because our software only runs in Kubernetes. It doesn't run on VMs, doesn't run anywhere else. So if you're not using Kubernetes, we provide you zero value. But if you're thinking about Kubernetes, there's a lot of things we can do.
So your education background's pretty awesome. MIT and Harvard Business. What did you do at MIT? Tell me, did you make robots or what?
So I studied computer science at MIT. I think my special talent was figuring out how to get to know people who were much smarter than me. So that way I could succeed in the coursework. So I did build a robot, competed in an autonomous robot competition. I was actually not very useful on the robot team. I think I procured snacks and assembled some Legos. But I had some very smart partners, and we actually made it to the playoffs with our robot. And then we lost to people who build even better robots. But we did actually quite well. But the credit is not to me.
Well, getting Legos and snacks, I mean, that is... The contribution is a contribution.
Exactly. Any way I could help.
So I have another product question, Richard. I'm sorry. I'm very product focused today.
Don't be sorry. That's what this podcast is about.
Do you mind elaborating about Argo, Argo 101? What is it? What's the name?
So Argo is a Cloud Native Computing Foundation project started originally by Intuit and BlackRock for continuous delivery. And what Argo does is you basically install it in your cluster and it implements a GitOps workflow. So any changes you make to a source repository that Argo is aware of, it actually synchronizes to your cluster. And by deploying Argo, you can actually create a true continuous delivery workflow where you can do things like make a change in your software, and it will incrementally roll it out as a canary release over time. And so we're big fans of Argo, and we've actually integrated Argo with our API gateway so that you can do something like, I have a new version 2 to replace version 1 of my software. And using Argo, you can create a policy that says incrementally ramp up traffic to version 2 over version 1 over the course of 24 hours. And if you detect anything anomalous, pause that rollout. And then behind the scenes, Argo will then orchestrate and control how much traffic is flowing to version 2 using emissaries APIs. And so there's a whole bunch of integration that needs to happen between our API gateway and Argo and your cluster and your container registry. And so we've been working with the Argo community to kind of integrate this all so it's actually much easier for you to actually deploy and set up.
So if I understood correctly, this is basically an automated canary GitOps machinery.
Yes.
Is that how to put it?
Yes, exactly. And it plugs into your continuous integration system.
Wonderful. So Richard, do you remember your first customer? Again, what was the first product that you actually released under DataWire, which is today Ambassador Labs?
We released a product called the Microservices Development Kit. That was really the first product. But I would say that we didn't get a lot of traction. And in fact, I'm a little hazy about who actually ended up using it. We had a few customers. I'd say that the first sort of real customer using us that I remember very distinctly was this company called AppDirect. And they're sort of this e-commerce platform. They used the API gateway, and we're very excited because they even wrote a blog post about it. And that was huge for us because they basically said, well, this is what we're using in production for all of our traffic, and this is why we chose to use it. And so that was, I think, a seminal moment in our early company history.
So API Gateway was the product that made it.
Mm-hmm.
So what goes into the API Gateway, and what do you think should go into the proxy, into the Envoy? This question I was asked last week several times by prospects. Do you have any distinct thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think the way we think about it is the data plane is entirely built around the proxy. So anything that's directly managing that traffic is all Envoy proxy. And then for us, Ambassador is really a control plane for that data plane. So we're basically connecting to the Kubernetes API. We're monitoring the API for any changes. And then based on those changes, we're generating the necessary Envoy configuration to adjust your routing. So that logic around where the traffic goes and what do you do with that traffic, that's really part of the control plane. And so that's really part of, you know, the code that we write. And then the Envoy proxy, which we actually bundle, is really that data plane. And it actually takes care of the hard part of processing the different bytes that are coming across the wire in a high performance way.
And what type of functionality would you keep out of your API gateway?
if there are such.
I think the thing that we've seen people run into trouble with is when people start to put too much business logic into the API gateway. So you see this, actually, Netflix built an API gateway around Java called Zool. And the power of Zool was it provided a very extensible framework for you to really put anything you want into and run it at the edge. And so what happened was a lot of people started putting lots of business logic into Zool, and that really makes it very difficult to actually debug what's going on. Zool is a piece of operational infrastructure, and by putting in business logic, you make it much more fragile. And so we prefer a model, and we're seeing companies sort of go to a model where a lot of that business logic actually sits in microservices that are then invoked by the API gateway and traffic at the API gateway. So I would say I would discourage you from adding business logic into the edge as much as you can.
Thank you, Richard. One more question in my mind. Actually, this has been bugging me for the last 4 years, probably even five. It seems to me, no matter how I look at this Kubernetes and everything, its entire ecosystem, it seems like there is a lot to do with managing software management, and you're writing software that actually manages other software. And there's a lot of managing stock involved into what actually goes into the runtime, into your binaries. And this is, for me, making a huge distance from the simplicity of Unix philosophy that used to be everything is a file and, you know, used to keep things simple. And all of a sudden, you know, you can see the same thing with NPM. For those who are familiar, you want to do like hello world, you do NPM install, and all of a sudden it's 50 megabytes of JavaScript code is downloaded to your laptop just to get this hello world example in React or whatnot. And those are over complex engineering, seems to be unavoidable right now because this is how things are actually made and built. But I wonder, what is your take on this one?
Siri, it's a really good question. And I think with Kubernetes itself, I think the key difference is that the nature of software development has actually changed in a very fundamental way. And what I mean by that is in traditional software development, pre-cloud, you really, as a developer, were really responsible for writing code. And then you had a different team that was really responsible for actually running that code. And you would have release managers who was responsible for deploying that code. And today, with Kubernetes in the cloud, the model is very different. You are actually responsible for that full software lifecycle for your microservice. So I like to say a full stack developer now is a full lifecycle developer. And you also see this in security, right? Because security, you have this theme of shift left, DevSecOps. And so what we're seeing is that more and more, we're moving away from the specialist role where a dedicated security team is responsible for code security, or a dedicated operations team is responsible for operational excellence. And we're saying, hey, developers, you need to actually manage this. This is part of your sort of software lifecycle because it's cheaper to actually address these security and operational issues during development than they are post-production. And because of that, the nature of the infrastructure and software that developers need to manage has expanded dramatically. And so that's actually the inherent driver of that complexity. And, you know, I think there's a lot of different things that can be done about it. We're actually working on a bunch of stuff in this area. We'll be announcing at KubeCon EU on May 4th. But this is the fundamental challenge. The nature of software development is changing, yet the tooling and infrastructure that software developers are being asked to use haven't really adapted to this new mode of work.
By the way, if everything is fully automated, CI, CD, everywhere, everybody is, you know, using a bunch of tools, and yet you see people working so hard for so many hours every day and that many days every week. It seems like, I would imagine, comparing, you know, a decade ago, software development to today, you would expect developers to work like 2 hours a day, 3 hours per day, just writing this pure algorithm, and everything else should have been automated. But we're so far from there.
You could argue that Kubernetes has accelerated productivity in some dimensions, right? Like the last mile software delivery, clearly cloud beats CD-ROMs any day of the week. But the flip side is developing for the cloud is way more complicated in a lot of ways and way more responsibility and way more to understand than just building, you know, GUI Windows app using Microsoft Foundational Classes.
Where do you see Ambassador Labs, Richard, in, say, 5 years?
So we're very focused around improving that app developer experience on Kubernetes. And so our vision is that people in 5 years who are developing Kubernetes are using our suite of tools to really do their daily development, whether it's Telepresence or Ambassador or Argo or all of them. This is what we think people should be doing, because we're seeing that when people actually understand how to adopt and use these tools, they can actually really improve their productivity and ship software faster.
Awesome. You know, the hardest part of doing this podcast is having to wrap up. I would love to just keep going, and maybe we could do a part two sometime soon.
I'm all for part two, Richard.
Yeah.
I have so many questions.
It's great talking to you guys. Love being on here. So thanks for having me.
Community updates. This week, we have a new portal on the CNCF website. So turn your browser to community.cncf.io/curiefence. That's CURIEFENSE. There you'll be able to get updates on our next community meeting, indeed our first community meeting. And we're looking forward to having you on there. Thanks.